This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 26th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. In celebration of Monocle's annual quality of life issue, this week's show has an urban improvement focus. We hit the streets of our number one city to see how exactly it's getting it so right. We also look at initiatives in Milan and London, aimed to inject a bit of love and life into their bleak urban landscapes. Coming up, we talk to the movers and shakers in Zurich, this year's number one city in our quality of life survey.
Here things last. Here there is a lot of money to develop stuff. That's what I like about this place.
We sit down with Stefano Boeri, architect and city planner, to hear about his vertical forest apartment blocks in Milan.
So in this case, what we are really interested to produce is a skyscraper who will change its presence, its image season by season. So it will be, from an aesthetical point of view, a mutant architecture.
And we hear about the fun and frolics hitting London this summer as the Cultural Olympiad rolls into town.
Just looking at Anish Kapoor's wonderful sculpture towering over the Olympic Stadium, that does the job, I think, for us. It reminds you that we have great artists as part of the London 2012 celebrations, as well as great sports people.
All that, plus we chew over the revolutionary concept for a drive-through airport, and we consider the Arabic notion of home at a brand new exhibition in London. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D. Zurich has topped the annual Monocle Index of the world's most livable cities, and even a cursory visit to Switzerland's largest city will tell you why. Efficient public transport, green spaces, and a lake to dunk in and drink from are just some of the qualities that have put this city on top. Recently, the creatives have moved in too, transforming its fusty banking image with increasingly innovative architecture, design, and retail projects. In this design dispatch, Monocle reporter Jennifer Davies introduces us to three people whose work is helping to shape Zurich's new design districts.
For years, the west of Zurich has played second fiddle to the east with its quaint old town and Gold Coast wealth. Yet the city has always been design conscious, with a prolific graphic design heritage. Now the former red light district and industrial areas of Kreis 4 and 5, or Kreis 4 and 5, are being reshaped. And I'm meeting some of those who are changing the way we view the city.
I'm Fabian Herman, associate at EM2N Architects, leading the competition department. Let's have a quick walk here and then maybe go to the city, no?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're now in our office space, basically, where everybody is drawing and thinking and working. This design school of Zurich will be opened in 2013. The building is almost the size of Centre Pompidou in Paris. That's huge.
So just as we step out of your office here, we're on Langstrasse, which is part of the red light district of Zurich. Is it important, do you think, for EM2N to be in the area that they're regenerating or building upon?
There's a lot of life in the streets all day, and that's pretty nice if you're a hardworking architect. I think the roughness in parts, considering we're in Switzerland, which is a country with a high standard of living, this is actually always giving new inspirations to the works we do. The dominant style of architecture in Zurich is not easy to describe. I think you have different atmospheres within the city. So we have the old city, where actually not many things change. But then you get to areas which are in a constant transformation, like maybe this area where we are now. Because it used to be the poorest people and the hookers area. We move on actually to former industrial areas, Kreis 5, where you actually have a huge change of the face of the city. Now we are approaching Josefswiese. So these arches cut between these two areas, housing and industrial area. And a while ago the city decided to connect these areas. So within these arches we find a lot of different shops and restaurants and also some social projects like kindergartens and stuff. So this really became a social tool to interact between the different areas and to improve both. We are now on Hartbrücke next to Prime Tower, Zurich. And we are actually having a look over the city now, which is pretty nice. You can see the lake and the mountains in the distance and the old city. And then if we turn ourselves, we see Kreis 5 under transformation. In far distance you see the Toni Areal, which will host the design school of Zurich, which we are designing in our office. So Zurich will get a new skyline in future. So this is becoming a new area of living and working now.
I'm Barbara Furrer, I'm 28, and I'm the owner of the Fashion Slave Menswear and Style Gallery. We decided to focus on men, and so it's not only fashion we sell, it's also styling we have in the store. So as you can see, the clothes, they're hanging on like iron polygon
structures.
Exactly.
So as we look around here, everything is shaped in a very polygon style, yeah. All made of wood. And you say this is all by young designers?
Mm-hmm. They were friends, actually. Yeah, we knew them. So we asked them to help us to realize our concept. Our clothes, we buy them in Paris or in Berlin at the Fashion Weeks. But we also support young designers, local designers from Zurich. We have quite a few. They can use our platform for their collections. So, and it's really nice. We have a good mix, avant-garde fashion and then local designers we support. Around us are the clubs. So that was our idea, to bring clients here in our store. They can get dressed and also be styled for going out. So we take the tram to the Limaplatz and then the bus to the Helvetiaplatz. People in Zurich, I think they do more. A lot is going on and that inspires me. And we're walking now to the Volkshaus.
It's the interior that's quite inspiring. It's quite industrial ceiling with neon attached to the ventilation shaft.
It's an old place and now it's new with this nice combination of the old history. This is very popular actually in Zurich. Old places are taken by people and they build it in a new way, in a new style. The city is very multicultural, very open for new concepts. There are many young urban people who are interested in what you do and support you. So Zurich is very open-minded and an open-minded city, and that's why we decided to start here. And that's what I like about Zurich.
My name is Matthias Frey. I'm a furniture and interior designer. I came to Zurich when I was 2 years old, and ever since I lived in Zurich. In terms of the stuff that we do, young design, locally produced design, Kreis 4 and 5 is definitely the area where at the moment this is happening. The Kreis 4, like where we are right now, is up and coming a bit slower than across the bridge, where it's up and coming faster. Quite a few young designers have chosen to come here, to have the shops here, because they can afford it. And because a lot of them are like self-employed, just starting like their own thing. It's still sort of neighborhoody, it's not so trendy. The MF system is a light shelving system. It's sort of like a bit edgy, different colors, materials. you can really easily make it individual, and that's what makes it very much alive. At the time I studied at the art school, end of the 80s, I was the same year as Alfredo Aperli, and he actually introduced me to Hannes Wettstein, where I did an internship. I got sort of hooked to design from then on. It was just Hannes and me, and we did everything on our own. We did the models, we did the mock-ups, we went to see the clients, we did the prototypes, and that was really what I really loved about it. Here things last. Here there is a lot of money to develop stuff. That's what I like about this place. I find it very fresh, refreshing. It's like a pseudo downtown area. I think Zurich, it gives it a new drive. It's not just an illustration of capitalism at all. I think it's just really interesting, this combination of new and old stuff. And for me as a furniture designer, there's new concepts to life. Then obviously there's new concepts to furniture to support this new life. And I think that's what pretty much is happening a bit in the west of Zurich.
So it seems Zurich's developing the old, embracing the shock of the new, and looking to a future of strong style, design and architecture.
That was our reporter Jennifer Davids in Zurich, our number one city, proving it's not just banking and chocolates that make it tick. Now, recent visitors to Milan will have no doubt noticed the construction cranes at work in the city centre, where one of Europe's biggest urban redevelopment schemes is in full swing. But among all the concrete and glass, an innovative residential project is in the works that gives new meaning to the term green architecture. Our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, spoke to Stefano Boeri to find out more.
In the heart of Porta Nuova, a new neighbourhood of 300,000 square metres, there stand two apartment towers. But these aren't your average residential blocks. Rising 26 stories high, they will feature large terraces and balconies covered in acres of vegetation, everything from shrubs and plants to tall trees. Bosco Verticale, or vertical forest, is the brainchild of Milan architect Stefano Boeri, who sees his design as a way to radically alter the city skyline.
The 40% of skyscrapers and towers have been built worldwide in the last 6 years. And I think basically in this period, 99% of skyscraper and tower have been completely surrounded by glass facade. So what we are trying to do here in Milano is to imagine to have a new generation of tower and skyscraper whose the vegetal facades, whose the trees, plants, shrubs. So leaves are capable to absorb the urban pollution, the dust, urban pollution. They produce oxygen. They reduce the thermal excursion between internal and external spaces. The other point is that a skyscraper, a tower, is always a public building, a public architecture, because it is exposed to the gaze of the entire city. So in this case, what we are really interested to produce is a skyscraper who will change its presence, its image, season by season. So it will be, from an aesthetical point of view, a mutant architecture.
What were the particular challenges with designing a building and having to support so much vegetation?
Well, we have worked from the beginning with the staff of botanics and structural engineers who has worked very well with us in order to imagine the best structure to maintain the weight of the plots surrounding the building at every store, at every floor. And then we have worked also from expert of the relation between wind and trees. We have tested the trees in Miami and Milano at the Polytechnic at the Gallery of Wind just to check if the trees will be capable 100, 120 meters to resist to a certain amount of wind. So we have really done all our efforts in order to test every kind of situation.
So is this sort of the new eco building? Because people are talking about everything being more eco.
I think it's really an experiment. I'm very proud that this will be done in Milano. And I think we'll need 2 or 3 years before understanding exactly how it will work. So because we need that the vegetation will grow and to complete the presence of the vegetation on the facade of the building. So it will be really intriguing.
With hundreds of plant species, from magnolias to olive trees to look after, prune and water throughout the year, Bosco Verticale is an expensive undertaking. But developer Heinz Italia, the company behind the Porta Nuova project, it sees the vertical forest as an investment that will hopefully put not just Milan, but Italy on the map as a leader in sustainable architecture. Manfredi Catella, CEO of Heinz Italia.
Bosco Verticale is a very special building within Porta Nuova. First of all, for the location. In fact, the building is located within an existing neighborhood of Milan, which is very important historically, with a lot of tradition, it's kind of a Soho of Milan. And Bosco Verticale is willing to be the jewel of all our sustainable effort that we made within Porta Nuova. Porta Nuova itself has more than 25 buildings, all certified by LEED. We use renewable energy across the three projects. And here in Isola, we went in an innovative way also to put in a common system the office building designed by Bill McDonald, the famous American guru of sustainability, with Bosco Verticale. So the two buildings share the same MEP system, so that the energy dispersed by the office building is actually reused for Bosco Verticale. And in addition to that, we went far away on the frontier, also with this green facade, which is for real. We made a lot of studies from a wind, from a sun perspective, from the durability of this green facade, and I believe it's going to be one of the landmarks, not just for Italy, but for the international architecture.
Now, this is a very expensive project. You have a lot of trees, you have to support the weight, irrigation. It must have cost a lot.
Certainly, there is an extra cost, exactly for the reason you mentioned, particularly on the structural standpoint and for the maintenance of the green. But I can tell you that the sales that have already occurred recognize a premium which is in the order of 20 to 30% to the current price of the neighborhood. So there is a general appreciation by the market about quality design for a purpose, not just for aesthetic.
And you see this as a thing that could be something for the future for other apartment buildings, whether it's New York, London, to adopt?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the trend is already well-defined and it's certainly not a new trend. I believe that within the trend, this building had a real case history.
That was our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho with Milanese architect and urban planner Stefano Boeri. Time for a short break, but stick around. We'll be finding out about London's Cultural Olympiad after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful woman. Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in the garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
Welcome back. London isn't just hosting the world's finest sportsmen for the Olympic Games this summer. the city is also opening its doors to the world's architects and designers. There's an unbelievable amount of exhibitions, talks, festivals, workshops and cultural merriment taking place in the name of celebrating cultural diversity in the British capital. I sat down with one woman at the centre of much of this, Vicky Richardson, Head of Fashion, Design and Architecture at the British Council.
We first worked with London's embassies during the London Festival of Architecture in 2008, and we realised this sort of huge appetite for finding out about the world. And we had around 20 countries involved. And then in 2010, we had twice as many countries, around 40. So for this year, the Olympic year, we anticipated that there'd be a lot of interest. So we've actually extended the event for 3 months, and it's now the International Architecture and Design Showcase. So it's including the London Festival of Architecture and the London Design Festival. And we're working with around 53 countries.
53 countries, yeah. My goodness. And you, as the head of design, architecture and fashion at the British Council, have been responsible for coordinating all the work with the embassies and inviting the embassies, first of all, to participate or to raise awareness for the fact that this is something that's happening.
We're part of the London 2012 Festival, and the British Council is organising a number of different contributions to that. World stages we're working on, River of Music, the Big Dance. So the British Council's role in those kind of events is really to bring in the international dimension. So I suppose whereas most of our work happens overseas and is about working with British designers and architects overseas, this is a project where we're doing the reverse. We're bringing projects from around the world to London to have a conversation about, you know, an international dialogue in our home city. And that's all very much part of the sort of Olympic spirit of welcoming and friendship, as well as excellence and, you know, putting the emphasis on really high quality ideas.
I mean, the things that are happening in London on an international sort of level seem to just be extraordinarily huge. Do you think that in many ways people see London as a much easier sort of place because it is such an international city in which to sort of raise these discussions of sort of multiculturalism, and, you know, it's a very good platform for anybody to come and show what they do and what's happening in their country in architecture and design or whatever else, whereas maybe sort of to try and set up that in Beijing 4 years ago might have been slightly more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think the world has there are a number of sort of international opportunities around the world now. But London is certainly, when it comes to architecture and design, I think the strength of our schools of architecture, design colleges, art colleges, I think the fact that there are so many overseas students here who often stay and set up their own studios, that provides a real natural basis for this kind of event, because often you find the embassies working with either students or curators or designers who from their country who found a home in London. And so it makes a lot of sense.
Things are already in process and in motion able to actually arrange these things quite easily. And what are some of the highlights or sort of exhibitions or events that we have to look forward to?
Yeah, well, we have a really interesting group show with 5 countries participating at the P3 space at the University of Westminster, P3 Ambika, it's called. And that's, as you probably know, it's a huge cavernous
space, which is
a brilliant venue for building installations and having shows and so on. So that's going to be a really interesting hub called the Architecture of Change. And it's featuring a really diverse array of countries. So we've got Serbia, South Africa, Namibia, Taiwan,
wonderful,
and the Caribbean. And I think that what we're keen to do there is to have a programme which puts the emphasis on the role that architecture and design can play in terms of sharing ideas around the world. So there's a whole talks programme there, which starts on the 2nd of July and will involve British-based architects as well as lots of the people who are travelling to London to take part in these exhibitions.
This is so exciting. So there's going to be a wealth of coverage on my doorstep for Section D in the future.
Oh, yeah. Well,
where can people who might be passing through London sort of find out exact sort of times and sort of details of events? Is it all on the British Council website? Or?
Yes, you can. There's a number of different places where you can find details. You can go to the London2012.com, or you can go to for the P3 space, p3hubspace.org.uk, or you can go to Back of the Envelope, which is the British Council design blog.
Fantastic.
The thing I really ought to mention is the London Festival of Architecture, which has the theme, The Playful City. And I don't know if you've noticed around London, pineapples appearing everywhere.
I have, pink yes. pineapples pink seem to be cropping up everywhere.
Yes. Well, it's kind of timely because apparently in the fashion stakes, pineapples are all the rage.
Oh, really?
Pineapple jackets and shirts and so on. But the pineapple is actually the sort of, well, in the 19th century was a kind of international symbol of welcoming and hospitality. Sailors who'd come back to the UK successfully, all in one piece, would hammer a pineapple to their front door to show that they were safe. And then all the best dinner parties would have pineapples as a sign that they were the most fashionable
exotic
and
traveled.
Kind of exotic. Exactly. So we've, for the Olympic year, we sort of picked up on this symbol, and we're going to be, the British Council, we're one of the co-partners of the festival. So there's going to be an array of kind of pineapple-based activities.
That sounds great fun. Messy.
That's right.
Maybe
yeah.
a bit sticky.
So lots for people to
heaps
take
for people
part
to see.
In.
And the London Festival of Architecture runs sort of over the next 3 months?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, it's short and sweet. It's 23rd of June to the 8th of July.
8th of July,
it's in
okay.
several different hubs around London. So you've got hubs at King's Cross, Southwark, Hoxton, City of London, and also the London Pleasure Gardens at the Royal Docks, which is going to be quite exciting, a whole series of experimental structures by young architects out there.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah,
and
it's a pleasure.
Keeping us in tune with all that's happening in London and the world of architecture and design. Vicky Richardson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And in the spirit of rousing Olympic glory, this is Hero by College. That was College with the anthemic song Hero. With the London 2012 Olympic Games just a few weeks away, London's Cultural Olympiad was launched last week. Promoting culture and the arts was a central part of the London bid and was recognised as one of the key reasons why it beat off its rival cities. Monocle's David Pleasant met the Cultural Olympiad director, Ruth McKenzie, to find out exactly what a Cultural Olympiad is.
We already have, as part of the London 2012 Festival, a wonderful exhibition, the first retrospective of Thomas Heatherwick's at the V&A, at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And actually, thrillingly, after the opening ceremony, Thomas Heatherwick's cauldron, which of course he's designed for that Olympic ceremony, will come to the V&A, to the Victoria and Albert, to join it. And we also have a fantastic partnership with the British Council and with the cultural attachés and embassies of London to showcase designers from each of their countries in embassies and in public spaces, which we didn't push today, but we will be pushing in future briefings, because it's a lovely event. It's free, it's showcasing designers from around the world here in London. And I think I should also mention a beautiful project in Manchester called We Face Forward, which has 33 artists and designers from 11 countries in West Africa. It's the largest exhibition of contemporary West African crafts, designers and artists that we have seen in the UK. And that, in Manchester Whitworth Gallery and the Manchester Art Gallery, again free, I think is going to change the map for perceptions of contemporary West African art and design. Any cliche that you have in your mind, this will blow up.
Have you found it a struggle to kind of get people interested in the arts and in culture when it's primarily a sporting event? I mean, do you think it's been an easy process, or has it been a learning curve for all of you?
Well, you know, I think it's important to remember the history here. So, of course, in ancient Greece, artists and sports people both took part in the Olympic Games, and that was taken for granted. And actually, when Baron Pierre de Coubertin founded the modern Olympic movement, he said he wanted it to be about art, sport, and education. when the UK went to Singapore to win the Olympics, because we are so brilliant at culture and creativity, as you heard the Secretary of State say, we said that we wanted to fulfill Baron Pierre de Coubertin's promise and put art back there with sport, so that we would represent the three pillars, art, education and sport.
That had gone missing, do you think? That had been lacking in previous games? Do you think London's going to rectify that?
You heard me getting told off for hype. So probably 2 days before the festival opens, it's not for me to say if we can be the best cultural Olympiad programme. Of course we would like to. Particularly, I think it would be great if we can, as Jeremy Hunt said, make sure that people remember London 2012 as much for the culture and creative industries as for the sport. Mm-hmm. And Barcelona maybe is our biggest competitor there, because I think what people remember of Barcelona's Olympic Games is that it put Barcelona on the map as a city of culture and creativity. London is already a city of culture and creativity, but it's my job to show that the whole of the UK is a place where you can come as a cultural tourist and have a fantastic time. It isn't only sports people who can have world records. So we have already broken the world record for the largest ever creative team of a film, with the Aardman, who make Wallace and Gromit, and the Tate, working with 34,000 children to create this wonderful film, The Itch of the Golden Knit. The Itch of the Golden Knit has won a BAFTA as well as a world record. And of course, Anish Kapoor has already broken a world record for the largest sculpture in the world. And if we want to put art back at the heart of the games, just looking at Anish Kapoor's wonderful sculpture towering over the Olympic Stadium, that does the job, I think, for us. It reminds you that we have great artists as part of the London 2012 celebrations, as well as great sports people.
In terms of legacy, and everyone's talking about Olympic legacy, and I go back to my question about designers and the creative industries, what do you think is the legacy for them? You mentioned the investment, or the funding, or rather investment that you want to describe it as. What will be their legacy? Do you think you're investing in their futures as well?
I think it's not just the investment to create the festival programme. It's more that we have 40,000 journalists from all around the world coming to the UK this summer. And we are pushing every single creator, designer, artist in this festival. I have done more interviews with television crews and radios and newspapers from more countries in the world than I have ever done, and the festival hasn't even started. We have a chance, with the eyes of the world on us, to push some of our great creators. And actually, I am confident that one of the great legacies will be more tourists coming to the country for our culture and creative industries, and also more chances to export work around the world. For example, the Tate movie we just spoke about, that is being invited to festivals around the world. And many of the projects that we are premiering here are then travelling around the world. So we are exporting some of our great talent, thanks to the summer of 2012.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant with London's Cultural Olympiad director, Ruth McKenzie. One of the Olympiad's first shows to open is at the Mosaic Room in West London and looks at the concept of home in the Arab world. Organised by the Museum of Architecture, along with the British Council's International Architecture and Design Showcase, architects from Morocco to Yemen were invited to ponder the issue at a time when nothing seems certain anymore in the Middle East. So what did these architects have to say? Beirut's Monocle correspondent Carol Korn was at the opening last week.
A new exhibition organised by the Museum of Architecture at the Mosaic Rooms in West London looks at the notion of home in the Arab world. At this point, images of harems and secluded courtyards surrounded by grand archways and the sound of trickling fountains might come to mind. Yet the group of architects brought together here offer a very different picture, one that is in flux and that challenges Orientalist tropes about architecture in the Arab world. For Moroccan architect Tariq Walalu of Kilo Architects, households cannot be reduced to archetypical typologies, but rather to a set of objects that are found in any Moroccan household, wherever you go in the world.
The theme for the exhibit was home, and as architect, we wanted to move away from the notion that the home was the house. It wasn't about discussing the typology or how in the Arab world we move from the courtyard house to contemporary buildings. We wanted to look at how the identity of home exists and gets carried. And for this, we looked at the Moroccan diaspora, which has a very strong tie to Morocco. And everywhere in every house of a Moroccan abroad, you always have the same feel that they recreate the house. So we wanted to understand how it worked. And after a survey, we realized they all have the same 10, 12 objects that they bring back from Morocco. And these objects aren't about the house, they're about the rituals of the home that really recreates it. And it's interesting to us because it's a strange connection between what contemporary Morocco is and frozen moment in time of what these people who live Morocco, who live with these objects, take away with. So in the 60s, they would have a certain image of Morocco. In the 80s, they had a different image of Morocco. And people who live now as students and go study in the States or in France, they also come back with a set of items and recreate rituals of what Morocco is today. So it's interesting to us because it gets us to really understand what the Moroccan home is without talking about the typology, and also to really understand the strong both political and sociological relationship of the diaspora to the homeland.
So if the Moroccan home cannot be reduced to architectural features, where does that leave the traditional house?
So it's not about recreating something that actually never existed. That kind of tradition is a mirage, which had a political presence and had a certain importance at a time. But right now, we have to move away from it. And there's certain empowerment of the contemporary culture that need to exist. And that's absolutely what we're doing. We don't consider ourselves being Moroccan architects. We're architects who practice in Morocco the same way we practice in France or England or in the States. We try to be contextual in the same way. There's no reason why we should be more contextual in the Arab world than we are in France or in England. That kind of symmetry is important because we are victimizing ourselves culturally. When you listen to all the discourse about the culture in the Arab world, it's all about preservation. It shouldn't be about preservation. Nobody wants to live in a courtyard house anymore. Nobody wants to live in the Medina. You can't park your car. You can't take your groceries in. So it's not desirable. Nobody wants to build a mud house. It's beautiful. It's a great idea. But it's economically not viable. Nobody will do it. And it's irrelevant, which is not to say that it's not beautiful and that it's not great. Some people think about it. But what's at the core of our work is trying to find a relevant position. And that's not about a mystification of kind of an oriental vision of what our culture is.
Egyptian architect Shahira Fahmi has a less drastic approach. Inspired by modernist Iraqi architect Hassan Fathi, she introduces the idea of fluidity and play to the classic Egyptian home.
What I'm talking about is the relationship between the in and out in our culture, in our city. I'm quoting one of the ladies that I interviewed during my research, and one of the things that she told me, the door of my home is never closed on us. It's always open, and the relationship between and out is very blurry. And she cannot shut this door on her kids because basically this is how she lives and how she works and how she's able to go to the market and leave the kids alone. So her only resolution is that the house is inside out. I'm talking about this relationship, about inside out, and how a boundary for people is not to have privacy or to secure, but it's only about just to define where they are and to designate their plot. Going through these houses, from even Islamic heritage houses, going to the vernacular houses, and then going to the red brick houses, which are now representing 60% of Egyptian urban growth or built environment. When you experience the house, it gives you a feeling of a hide and seek. And this made me remember Hassan Fathi saying a good house is a house where kids are able to play hide and seek. And how this maze-like house is going from a brother to another and another in one shell gives you this entertaining or life to the building.
That was Carol Corm reporting in London there. Time for a quick break, but stick around as we find out how a drive-through airport might be the answer to our travelling woes after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Check-in queues, border bedlam, tarmac terrors and carousel chaos. You don't need me to tell you that airports today are fairly horrid. Amsterdam-based architect Miklos Derry has developed a concept for a drive-through airport, which he claims will cut cost and speed and increase efficiency. Intrigued, I asked Derry to explain a little further how exactly a drive-through airport might work.
Basically, it came out of kind of a frustration I had, and both frustration and fascination for aviation and for flying. I thought it's based on the idea of an assembly line, of a car wash. Based on the graduation project I did, so I had a research, I did an instinctive research about the airports, went and interviewed a lot of stakeholders to get an overall picture. I came up with the idea of trying to revolutionise it in a way.
Because the host of discussion that we have many times is that airports simply don't function as well as they should do for the enormous and increasing number of people who pass through them. So you've come up with this very innovative solution to have a drive-through airport, which cuts down sort of the time that it takes to process passengers and also the time that it takes for aircraft to fly in and fly out quite dramatically. Maybe describe the project a little bit for us.
Yeah, maybe to understand it more easily is if you imagine a train station where you have the tracks, let's say 8 tracks next to each other, and if you exchange the trains by aircraft and take the platforms and elevate the platforms instead of between the tracks, elevate above the aircraft, then you end up with basically the airport itself. So what makes it so efficient is that you don't block a gate for the full amount of time of the aircraft spending time in the airport, but you divide the servicing activities of the aircraft in 3 different pit stops. And by doing so, you only block one particular place for 1/3 of the time, of the overall time of the what the aircraft spends on the ground. So you have to imagine if an aircraft comes in, you have passengers getting out of the plane. That takes approximately 15 minutes maximum. And instead of one bridge, I would use 2 bridges, so it would take less than 5 minutes overall. Then you would move the aircraft forward to the next position and do the servicing and the cleaning. And after another 15 minutes, you would move them forward to the final position, to the departing position, where you would basically only have to board the aircraft and the aircraft would leave the stand. The benefit would be that you would have all the passengers would basically board the aircraft from, like basically cynically spoken, from in the middle of a shopping mall. Because you don't have to move to any remote boarding lounges and you don't have to walk there 10, 15, maybe even 20 minutes further away to wait and sit there for your aircraft, because you're basically in a larger mall center and part of the mall has boarding lounges and you would basically just start your flight from these boarding lounges in the middle of the departing hall.
It sounds like an ingenious solution. I mean, you just explained it very carefully there, that the aeroplane moves forward to 3 different stages rather than having it sat sort of blocking one place for sort of 3 times the amount of time that it would normally take. Why do you think nobody's thought of it in this way before?
If you think of the last 60 years, if we see where has been breakthroughs in technology, it's been more concentrated on airline of airplanes. So they became less noisy, more fuel efficient, and more environmental friendly. And the typology of airports has never been really looked at because the airports always reacted to newer airplanes rather than trying to reinvent themselves. And there was no need for it. So I think the problem became now kind of evident that there is a problem, because they're just simply reaching this size where they're simply too large to be handled properly. So there are the congestion on the taxiing on the ground, and the pollution, the increasing pollution.
And the sheer distance that you have to walk when you're there as well, when they just keep on growing and growing.
Exactly, from the view of the passenger, it just became too large to handle. So the transfer passes between getting out of one aircraft and getting into the other one also increased, and I think that now we are at this path where I thought that we have to rethink it, and I'm probably kind of maybe even 10 years too late with it, but I hope I'm not too late with it, because the amount of passengers increased so much more since the 90s when low-cost airlines came up, that it would be time now to reevaluate the notion what is an airport and try to make something out of it.
And is a concept like this, is it intended to actually be taken very seriously and to sort of be adopted by somebody who's building an airport from scratch? Or is it more just to sort of introduce different ways of thinking how existing airports might work better?
Of course, I mean, it sounds naive for me to say, but I really want to build it. And I see, of course, how difficult it is and how conservative and complex the aviation industry is currently. The question is, how long will we still be flying, burning fuel, and all these things? So there is no real answer for the next couple of decades. Will we fly another 50 years, or will it go endlessly? The question. So for me, it's really important. I really want to take this on and collaborate with many visionaries or positive or green thinkers who think that it is an inevitable situation and we have to make the best out of it. So I really want to take it on and build it either as a module in a given airport or, of course, maybe simpler as a greenfield airport.
Interesting. And you have actually presented this at some conferences before. And what's the reaction been to the design?
The reaction was mainly positive, but of course, also people started to drill little holes in it. But I always said you have to focus on the large concept, because, of course, you cannot present an airport just like that, and it's not buildable from now till tomorrow. But there was no real steady, hard argument against it. Why not? So if you really dig deep, and of course you find a lot of problems and questions, but they're all there to be solved.
That was Miklos Derry with his drive-through airport concept, talking to me earlier. And that brings us neatly to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be hearing about a carbon-negative furniture programme from designer Gareth Neal. We'll also be heading to Berlin and Sao Paulo to talk built environments. And we'll be looking at a giant cake in the shape of a church in London. Yum. Be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out, in celebration of the drive-through airport, here's Big Jet Plane by Angus and Julia Stone. Thank you for listening. Farewell.
She drives me crazy. She drives me crazy. Gonna take a for a ride on a big jet plane. Take a